Blog Talk Radio.
Listening and being part of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We've got another broadcast during the week that we hope you like. It's called From the Eastern Files. The program will be dedicated to memories and stories of former Eastern people and news from the new Eastern as we feel you might want to hear. These broadcasts will usually be about one half hour. We may go over just a little bit. And broadcast in the 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time slot. By the way, next week, we reset our clocks, I believe. We may even throw in a music selection or two. The program will not be on a talk radio format in that we will not take calls. It's reserved only for Eastern history and news. We continue to broadcast our normal talk radio call-in live show on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. We hope you like this new addition to the Eastern Radio Show. And now let's hear an Eastern commercial.
It's Sunday in Mexico. The sun floods an arena. The historic duel is on. The sun spotlights a diver at Acapulco. Referees a children's game at the pyramids of Teotihuacan. The sun warms a beautiful mermaid in Puerto Rico and covers the vacation paradise of Miami. Every year, more people choose this one to the sun because Eastern service is as warm as the destination.
Fly Eastern, number one to the sun.
Today we take our story from the 1991 issue of the Repartee magazine, and it is about Eastern's military operation. The great story you're about to hear was written by Captain Bill Malone, who wrote so many fabulous stories for the Retired Eastern Pilots Association's magazine. So let's start our story. In the early days of World War II, along about 1942, it was not uncommon to pull up to a railroad crossing, hear the scream of a locomotive whistle, and watch over 100 cars of long trains go rumbling by. Each car would be filled with materials related to the war effort. Tanks and armored vehicles were lashed down to flat cars. The high speed at which the train was traveling caused dust and debris to fill the air. The clickety-clack of the wheels on the tracks played the kind of a tune which brought home to you the fact that the enormous manufacturing machine of the United States was running at full speed. The war effort reached into every facet of production and into everyone's life. Women took over jobs formerly held by men who were now overseas. We affectionately referred to the female employee in the aircraft factory as Rosie the Riveter. Activity during the war reached a fever pitch. Those who were not employed busied themselves with rolling bandages, promoting the sale of war bonds, and operating daycare centers for the mothers who were away from home and working in the factories. There was a crying need for those with familiarity in technical fields, and more particularly, there was a most urgent need for those with aviation experience so that overseas routes could be established and vital supplies along with essential personnel could be transported to the warfront by air. Eastern Airlines responded with the formation of its operation, which became known as the MTD, or Military Transport Division and Air Transportation, to the far-flung bases through the Caribbean, South America, and across to Africa, was off to a flying start. The United States Air Force called upon Eastern's Captain Paul Foster to assist with the original survey flights in 1942. Paul discovered the general in command to be an old classmate from Kelly Field back in 1927. They spent 3 weeks together aboard a C-87 they appropriately named Old Nosy, and they nosed around all over South America and Africa, setting up air supply routes which were so vital to the war effort. With his ability and organizational know-how, Paul Foster helped create Eastern's MTD, and thus began the great adventure. In an age where the jet airplane has made possible the long flight segments of today, and where Omega and inertial navigation systems, INS, simplify navigation over the polar cap, it is hard to imagine that a flight from Atlanta to New Orleans nonstop would be considered at one time to be a long flight. Cruising at 39,000 feet, it is equally difficult to visualize the dangers of a long overwater flight in a two-engine propeller-driven plane or the hazards of flying over an inhospitable South American jungle. But these were the challenges that faced the Eastern pilots who would fly the MTD. There were few navigational aids and lots of uncharted territory. It was like stepping off the edge into the unknown. In its 3.5-year existence, Eastern's Military Transport Division flew 33,480,000 miles over open ocean and almost uninhabited jungle to carry 47,500,000 pounds of vital war cargo, ranging from ammunition and guns to badly needed airplane parts for the B-29 superfortresses operating in the Pacific. During its operation, 130,000 essential passengers were flown to or from the United States. In the 4 months from June 1945 to September 1945, more than 15,000 servicemen were flown back to the United States for redeployment or release. Although many airlines operated foreign and domestic routes for the Air Transport Command, Eastern Airlines earned the reputation of being the most dependable and the most economically operated. Eastern did not cancel a single scheduled flight because of weather, and only one plane was lost during the entire 3.5 years. Eastern established an admirable record of safety and dependability envied by all. Warren Jameson was one of the group who made the first survey flight to San Juan, Puerto Rico. Originally, the C-53 was utilized, but later 20 Curtiss C-46s were assigned as the operation was extended on to West Africa. Warren recalls vividly the unusual field conditions at some of the airports. On Ascension Island, out in the Atlantic, the engineers had bulldozed the top off this volcanic island for the runway. Since the asphalt was the same color as the lava rock, the tendency was to undershoot the landing. dozens of bombers lie at the foot of the valley. The wreckage was pushed aside to clear the way for other landings. He remembers witnessing a British de Havilland Mosquito piling up on the approach end and depositing a Rolls-Royce Merlin engine on either side of the runway. Miraculously, the pilot walked away from the pile of plywood, which had been the fuselage. Other events he was exposed to did not have such happy endings. Enemy submarine activity had become heavy in the area around Trinidad. Approaching at daybreak, he and his crew sighted a freighter under attack. After the torpedo hit, the ship's crew could be seen jumping off the deck into the water, and all efforts to raise Trinidad on the radio to request rescue were futile. They had to watch helplessly. Later, he and Lame Guthrie sighted an enemy submarine beginning to submerge just off Miami Beach. They were unable to obtain a response from a Navy training vessel nearby. No one could believe an enemy sub would come in that close to the United States. In October 1942, Eastern Airlines Military Transport Division became one of the first airlines to operate the new C-46 Curtiss Commando, the largest twin-engine plane at the time. Although the C-46 had many promising features, it was not without its share of technical bugs. O.B. Bonawit recalls losing oil pressure on a flight from Miami to Barrincon Field in Puerto Rico. Had it been any other kind of plane, they would have turned around and headed back. But this had happened before. When the red warning light did not come on as the oil pressure fell below 20 pounds, he suspected an error in the instrument. The C-46 had an oil line running all the way from the engine right to the gauge in the cockpit. To avoid loss of oil in case the line ruptured, a diaphragm was installed in the line near the engine, so the indicated pressure was only that in the line between the diaphragm and the cockpit. Any leak in that portion of the line would cause a drop in pressure to register. The pressure switch located on the engine controlled the red warning button in the cockpit and was more reliable. Serious problems arose due to the aircraft's faulty hydraulic system, however. Eastern grounded all C-46s for 2 weeks while the MDT maintenance department discovered the problem and corrected it. It made more than 300 changes in the C-46, most of which were adopted by the manufacturer. Curtiss gives Eastern mechanics much of the credit for developing the Commando. Their efforts helped make the C-46 dependable for flying the hump over in China during the war. Now, Gene Ramsey remembers how fortunate he was to fly his trips on the MTD with such Eastern pioneers as Paul Foster, Buck Hudgens, Tommy Holcraft, and Frank Junger, at a time when Gene had not even finished his first year probation with the company. Although the C-46 had an autopilot, Buck Hudgens preferred to fly it manually because he believed you should always keep your hand in when it came to flying. Buck taught Gene Ramsey well, and later, as an FAA designee, gave him his airline transport pilot rating. Tommy Holcraft carried a long stick with a suction cup on the end to operate the autopilot so he wouldn't have to lean so close forward to reach the knobs. The farther south they flew, the more primitive the conditions became. The crews started out staying in hotels, then ended up billeted in military barracks. Entertainment on the MTD consisted of poker games and occasional shopping. Although some consumer items were authentic, many were fake. One thing for sure, if you ate uncooked vegetables or fruit, you got the green apple quick step, as it was called. Frank Junger reminisces over the concern for the flight crews that Eastern's management felt. Approaching Trinidad on his flight to Natal, Brazil, he received orders from Mr. Shannon, Eastern's vice president of operations, to land and return to Miami. Roy Munoz volunteered to turn from his northbound trip and pick up the southbound flown by Frank, whose six-month-old son, Philip, had been admitted to the hospital with pneumonia. He recovered, and Frank developed a fierce loyalty to Eastern as a result of his experience. He also found a soft spot in his heart for the friendship of his friend, Roy Munoz. Young Philip grew up to serve in Vietnam, marry, and become one of the architects who designed the Atlanta Dome Stadium. John Halliburton was promoted to director of flight training, and Eastern's training department really cranked up. He assumed the responsibility of training nearly 100 pilots each month, as well as mechanics and navigators for Army Air Corps. The pilot training section of his division flew as many as 5,000 hours monthly, moving high-priority freight between military air depots throughout the eastern United States. New Army Air Corps lieutenants received their instrument training from Eastern before being assigned to fly the hump and other areas. With the end of the war and the job of flying veterans back from South American bases almost complete, Eastern Airlines ended its military transport division with the satisfaction of a job well done. All of those who participated were commended by Army officers at every Caribbean and South Atlantic base served by Eastern Airlines for the thoroughness and dependability of their 3.5 years of operation. In 1967, the United States government again called upon Eastern Airlines, this time to transport servicemen and their dependents to and from the far-flung areas of the world. The operation was then called the MAC, or Military Air Command Charters. It began with Eastern using the Douglas DC-861, three of which had been ordered in 1965. They provided long range and high capacity, carrying 199 passengers. As delivery of the aircraft began in 1967, the first plane was flown to France and exhibited at the Paris Air Show. The initial flights were over the North Atlantic to Germany, and as more aircraft were ordered, the routes were extended to overseas bases in the far reaches of the Pacific, including Vietnam. Pete Peterson recalls that the problem facing Eastern was to adapt a civilian operation to a military operation. Eastern's civilian operation had not involved such long flight segments. Rarely were the planes flown at the maximum gross weight. Civilian competition required that the aircraft be operated in the most efficient configuration, which would be at a lighter weight and at a high altitude. A competent dispatch department wasn't available for assistance, and flight watch was not there. But the military operation required that every flight be flown at the very maximum gross weight. Pete remembers using every bit of the runway for takeoff. The controls would be heavy, and you would have to fly for miles at takeoff power before a climb could be even established. Normally, a takeoff in the DC-8 took approximately 22 seconds. Sonny Seaman remembers a takeoff roll taking 62 seconds while flying the MAC. Each flight covered such a long distance that fuel requirements stretched the aircraft capability to the very limit. High-altitude flight could not be achieved until much of the heavy fuel load had been burned off. Even though it was a long-range aircraft, the DC-861 did not carry enough fuel to provide much margin to operate nonstop over these extended routes. If you were making a flight from Frankfurt, Germany, to McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey, you could not fly much beyond Philadelphia as an alternate airport, and you could just about spit that far. The flight crew had to do its own dispatching. Decisions were often made right in the cockpit regarding the conduct of the flight. The flight crew adapted to the conditions that were existing. A typical example would be a flight made by Rollo Owen. He departed Idlewild Airport in New York on a ferry flight bound for Honolulu, Hawaii. There were no passengers, and the plane was loaded to the maximum with fuel. Normally, they would have stopped somewhere on the West Coast for additional fuel. However, on the way across the continent, there was little or no wind. As they proceeded westbound, the wind shifted to the east, which was most unusual, and they were riding on a tailwind, which continued to increase. Approaching the coast of the United States, they determined that the flight could be made nonstop, so the flight continued to Honolulu without a landing in San Francisco. Sonny Seaman accepted the other direction, made a similar flight. He and his crew departed Okinawa for Honolulu, anticipating a tailwind up along the coast of Japan. They made ready for a nonstop flight. The tailwind was there with a force of 100 knots, so they were able to continue their flight on to their destination without making a fuel stop. Sometimes an unexpected headwind would be encountered. Vivid in the mind of Don Cole is his very last flight for Eastern Airlines prior to his retirement, and the anxious moments this experience caused him. He departed Scotland for New York in February of 1970. At 60 degrees north and 40 degrees west, they encountered a jet stream and a headwind of 130 knots, which lasted all the way to Hopedale, Labrador. He considered landing for fuel at Goose Bay or Loring, Maine, but there was one small problem. A raging winter blizzard covered all of Labrador. Fortunately, the wind shifted to the north, and they made it all the way to McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey. At this early date, navigation was performed utilizing Loran. Later on, Doppler was added. First flights were to England, Germany, and Spain to support the Cold War efforts in Europe. It was much cheaper and quicker for the U.S. Navy to change submarine crews by having the Eastern Mac pick up the fresh crew in Boston, deliver them to Spain via the Azores, and return with the tired crew due for rotation. P. Peterson remembers how wonderful the layovers were. Each Mac trip was like going on a vacation. While stopping over in Spain, the crews had time to take a car and drive over to the beach in the Mediterranean. There were fabulous places to eat in Madrid. Traffic moved on the Autobahn in Germany at speeds up to 150 miles per hour, while traffic on the Rhine River moved at a more leisurely pace through the famous winemaking country. In England, everyone enjoyed cool climate, beautiful cathedrals, and social life at the pubs. Some of the English buildings were erected in the 1200s and are still standing. As the Mac routes were extended from the West Coast to Vietnam, the flight crews enjoyed the scenic beauty of Hawaii and the versatility of the hula dancers, unbelievable as characterized by Pete Peterson. Bob Shipner cherishes the memories of the humorous events that often took place while flying the Mac. He was impressed by Sonny Seaman's ability to fly halfway around the world and back on $3.67. But then Bufkin Fairchild topped this record by making the same trip on $1.21. While touring the island of Oahu, he and Pete Peterson stopped to visit Pearl Harbor. The militant young Marine guard at the main gate took a dim view of their appearance as they presented themselves with appropriately loud Hawaiian shirts. He did a double take when Pete Peterson presented his ID card, identifying himself as a Brigadier General in the U.S. Marine Corps, and saluted them smartly through the gate. The base commander provided a private launch and crew to give them the grand tour of the facility. In any operation of this magnitude, there is always a story which touches the heart. Frank and Gertrude Junger had bid goodbye to their son, Guy, on a dreary dock in Norfolk, Virginia, one dark and rainy night as he left on a freighter as escort for his outfit's equipment and supplies bound for Camaran Bay and the war in Vietnam. Now it was nearly a year later, and his rotation date was coming up. Frank bid a trip, which would put him in Vietnam on this particular date. Things were looking good, but at the last minute, there was a schedule change. After an overnight on the West Coast, the schedule was restored, and 3 days later, Guy was waiting for his dad, having arrived at Camaran Bay just 2 hours earlier. Tears of joy were shared as they were reunited after 11 months. Ellis Traub and F.D. Moore took care of the paperwork so Frank and his son could enjoy a visit during the two-hour turnaround. Then Frank was off to the Philippines, Wake Island, and Honolulu. But the story did not end here. While waiting at the airport in Honolulu to pick up his segment of the flight from Vietnam back to the States, Frank wondered if his son would be aboard the eastbound flight carrying many returning soldiers. Tensions mounted. Everyone in his crew had their fingers crossed. Normally, processing back home would take a week to 10 days, but the procedure had been hastened with the help of an old high school classmate who was in charge of passenger assignments. Sure enough, Frank's son was a passenger aboard the flight, and Frank Junger brought his son back home from the war. It was the best trip he experienced in his 33 years with Eastern Airlines. As the flight crews proceeded to the origination point of their flights, usually McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey, one wonders what thoughts were in their minds as they made the limousine trip over from Philadelphia. Surely they must have anticipated some of the problems that would face them. What wind conditions would they encounter? What adverse weather would develop during the long flight segment? Would there be a lengthy delay? How would you manage sufficient rest if one occurred? How would you provide for the passengers in the areas where there were no facilities? Would you be able to get into some intermediate airport if additional fuel was needed? Would the aircraft take any hits from the enemy snipers hiding at the edge of the base at Camaran Bay? There must have been a great deal of stress involved just thinking about it. But the challenge that faced them more than made up for the trauma. The feeling of accomplishment buoyed their spirits and sustained them. It is no wonder they enjoyed themselves so much on the layovers. The MAC was an operation that called upon the flight crew, maintenance, and ground support personnel to give their greatest effort and provide their highest degree of professionalism to make it work. The safety record was superb. The people of the United States will always be grateful. And none who participated will ever forget what is called Eastern's Great Adventure. Well, that's one story and just a couple of little clips that I would like for my friend Howard Mucci to pull the pages from the Eastern Transport, Air Transport News Wing newsletter. And Howard, I'm going to see if I can plug you in here. And okay, Howard.
From Eastern Air Transport News Wing's newsletter, dated May-June 1933 issue. Nation's First Lady flies as Amelia Earhart's guest. Displaying again her love of flying, Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt made a night flight over Washington and Baltimore in a 1933 Curtiss Condor of Eastern Air Transport. She and her party were the guests of Amelia Earhart Putnam and included G. Hall Roosevelt, the First Lady's brother, George Palmer Putman, publisher, and Mrs. Eugene Vidal and Thomas B. Doe, president of Eastern Air Transport. Taking off from Washington Airport, the airliner climbed through the night skies to 3,000 feet. Amelia Earhart left her distinguished guest in the cabin and took the plane's controls, flying it to Baltimore. She then returned to the cabin, and Mrs. Roosevelt sat beside the pilot as he circled Baltimore and turned towards Washington. It was like looking down from the top of the world, the nation's first lady declared. Washington was marvelously beautiful from the air, and Baltimore so huge beneath our wings, it was an inspiring sight. Once before, Mrs. Roosevelt made a pleasure flight at night in a Curtiss Condor of Eastern Air Transport. This time, was over New York, and she declared it was like a trip through fairyland. Her Washington-Baltimore flight was in a new 1933-type Condor that had engineering features which made it the first quiet liner of the air, having a noise level of 7 decibels, the same as a Pullman car. The crew was composed of chief pilot E. H. Parker, co-pilot Earl Steele, and flying hostess Edwina Davis. Mrs. Roosevelt made 11 trips using Eastern Air Transport. Another clip from May-June 1933. Hostess on radio. Miss Marion Cook, flying hostess for Eastern Air Transport, recently told a national radio audience of the work she and others in the hostess department are doing. Miss Cook was a guest speaker on the Pennzoil program over the Columbia Broadcasting System. She has traveled over 255,000 miles in the Curtiss Condors of Eastern Air Transport in the performance of her duties.
Thank you very much, Howard. And that's our stories from the Eastern Files today. We hope you enjoyed these great Eastern stories for today's broadcast. And if you'd like to contribute a story of your own from your Eastern days and in your own voice or to be read on the broadcast, please give us an email and we will show you how simple it is to tell your story, and we'll put it in from the Eastern Files. Just send your MP3 sound recorded story to host@ealradioshow.com. We want you to be part of the radio show. Until next week and another broadcast from the Eastern Files, we say, so long, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern. And here's a new song that really tells the story of the Eastern employee. We'll be right back. We love you, Eastern family. Have a good day.